England's had a very long history of politics. And because of the long history, we tend to get a little bit cynical and tend to see politics often as no more than theatre. And in that respect, we also as a nation seem to rejoice in witnessing grand acts of political drama, eagerly watching the comings and goings of those in power. And, by equal measure, as we have seen this week, occasionally lose the better part of our faculties to watch what is utter nonsense and treat it like it's utterly important. But theatre has always been part of politics. And even in the midst of civil war and strife, London was to see grand acts of political theatre all through its history. But few could be as grand as the events of 1461. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the chronological story of our city as it travels through history. We are coming to the end of the year 1460, and everything in the country is in flux. And thus we come to the fifth part of the tale of London's Roses, the account of the city during the civil wars of this era, and the 166th chapter of this story of London. And this week, 2 years, which was to see London, well, develop political whiplash as the wars going on around it just seemed to toss them from defeat to victory to defeat to victory with such alacrity that honestly, I'm surprised people didn't get their necks broken. Welcome then to a great shedding of blood. And we start with the War of the Roses scorecard, November 1460 edition. Numbers of wars so far, 3. Numbers of times Henry VI has been captured, 2. Numbers of regime that have run the country since 1454, 6. Current regime, Henry VI is king, but Richard Duke of York is named his heir to the throne, and he and his supporters are running the country. The Duke of York had won. He oversaw the state, but he didn't have control of the entire nation. The Earl of Northumbria had started a bushfire insurrection against the takeover in the north of England, a wild, raiding war party of chaos and instability. Just across the border in Scotland, the Queen of England, Margaret of Anjou, was hiding out with her 8-year-old son, the recently disinherited former Prince of Wales, Edward. She saw this rebellion of the Earl of Northumbria as a chance for her and her people to regroup and start a new war, this time to try and take down the Duke of York. She summoned her supporters from Wales and the southwest to somehow get themselves and their armies all the way to Hull. Understand, this was a new war, and it was starting in completely the wrong time of year. This was winter. Nobody mobilised their forces in winter. No one mobilised disparate forces scattered all across the country and tried to force march them together way into the north in the middle of winter. Everything about this muster screamed of desperation and, to a degree, naivety. Queen Margaret seemed to be in over her head. This was a mad throw of the dice, driven by desperation and a fair degree of spite. And yet, the sheer insanity of it took everyone by surprise. When news of Northumberland's mobilisation reached the Duke of York in London, he and his supporters were staggered. A new war? A new force mobilising? The fear of him losing control of the government for a third time was more than enough to force the Duke of York's hand. Hastily, he decided this shit need to be closed down at once. The moment the Duke of York received intelligence, which brought details of Queen Margaret's movements, he and the Earl of Salisbury, who is fresh of his victory here in London pacifying the Tower of London, set out from the southeast to put down this new uprising and, quote, bring in the Queen, unquote. At the same time, in a second front, Edward, the Earl of March, the Duke of York's eldest son, went to Wales to face down an army rampaging there under Jasper Tudor, the half-brother of the King. On the 21st of December, the Duke of York had reached Sandal Castle, near Wakefield in West Yorkshire. The last time the Yorkists had marched out with an army, speed had given them advantage over the Royalist forces, but now it actually worked against them. The combination of weather and their incredible alacrity conspired to see that the Duke of York and the Earl of Salisbury were now sorely outmanned by the rapidly assembled partisans of the Queen. The Duke of York and his supporters therefore had to spend a rather meagre Christmas inside Sandal Castle, and they were forced to ration their food. And that was because their enemies were now overrunning the adjoining territories to prevent more getting in. And then, on December 30th, a foraging party was set up by the Duke of York. And these men were attacked by men loyal to the Earl of Somerset. Here, in the north, seeing men from the West Country operate so openly was clearly odd. And I've read at least one historian who has claimed that the former loyalist of the Earl of Warwick, Captain Andrew Trollope, a veteran of the brilliant Calais garrison who defected at the Siege of Ludlow to the Royalist side and had rapidly become one of their leading officers, had instigated that attack on the foraging party to lure out the Duke of York. If this theory is correct, then Trollope's a genius, because he succeeded. The Duke of York rode out of Sandal Castle just after the attack on his men, intent on driving away the attackers, and walked straight into an ambush. He was barely out of the castle when he found himself surrounded on all sides. His forces were outnumbered, perhaps 5-1, by men who not only opposed his political ambition, but for the most part genuinely loathed him. As a much later writer would describe it, quote, "He was environed on every side like a fish in a net, or a deer in a buckstall," unquote. The fighting was quite heavy and it lasted for about an hour. Seeing the situation was becoming impossible, he sent his other son, the Earl of Rutland, to flee. Rutland fled for Wakefield Bridge, which is an elegant 9-arched stone crossing over the River Calder. On the far side of Wakefield Bridge is the Chantry Chapel of St. Margaret the Virgin. We think the 17-year-old Earl of Rutland may have hoped to throw himself inside and claim sanctuary. Unfortunately, he didn't make it. Lord Clifford chased him from the battlefield with single-minded determination and caught up with him on or very near to the bridge. The Earl of Rutland was surrounded. Clifford stepped forward, cursed the young man, and told him to prepare to die, quote, "as your father slew mine," unquote. Intent on blood vengeance, Clifford drew his dagger and thrust it into the young man's heart. The son had been killed for the sins of his father. The father, however, was faring little better. Despite being surrounded, the Duke of York was desperately trying to fight his way back to Sandal Castle. But he didn't have the ability to, and he was seized in the scramble of the fight. Sir James Luttrell of Devonshire was named as his captor, and he was dragged away. His helmet was removed, and a rough paper crown was placed on his head. And to the sounds of jeers and mocking, of kicks and blows, Richard Plantagenet, the Duke of York, was paraded in front of his victorious enemies and swiftly beheaded. Other Yorkists died on the battlefield that day also. Besides York and Rutland, the Earl of Salisbury's son Sir Thomas Neville was also taken and killed. The Earl of Salisbury had escaped from Sandal Castle and was attempting to flee northward, but he made it little further than Rutland. After a harum-scarum and wild chase through the countryside, the victor of the Siege of the Tower of London was captured that night, and the 60-year-old Earl was dragged back to the enemy headquarters at Pontefract Castle. The next day he was taken out and executed in public. Soon after, the heads of the 4 dead Yorkist leaders were sent to the city of York to be displayed upon the Micklegate. There the Duke of York's dead eyes stared down at the passing subjects, his paper crown still jammed hard upon his cold, lifeless head. Years and years of fractious personal relationships and growing vendettas had caused this. The papal legate, Bishop Capponi, wrote at the time, quote, "acts of vengeance have been perpetuated on both sides," unquote. On paper, the Queen and her son, Prince Edward, had won. Finally, the Duke of York was dead. The rebellion was over. Only, well, you know, the King remained in the hands of the Earl of Warwick and Edward, Earl of March. And now it's time. War of the Roses scorecard, December 1460 edition. Numbers of wars, 4. Numbers of times Henry VI has been captured, 2. Numbers of regimes since 1454, 6, but the latest one's just fallen. Current regime, Henry VI is king, but with the death of the Duke of York, everything's up in the air. England was now fundamentally split into two. The Queen and her faction had just defeated their main rivals. But while they'd gotten rid of the head of that regime, they had not established their own regime, as the King was still in custody with the Duke of York's supporters. Neither side seemed strong enough to defeat the other. This fourth war was simply politics now sitting as cover over a myriad of blood feuds and vendettas, a spasm of violence that meant whatever happened, this war would continue. And for London and the Londoners, this defeat and death of the Duke of York was a huge setback, because London was fairly well in the Yorkist camp. The grocers had advanced money to the Duke of York's son, the Earl of March, to finance his campaign in the Welsh Marches. They lent £200, which was raised by subscription from individual members. The grocer mayor, Richard Lee, had made the highest contribution, closely followed by the aldermen John Young and William Taylor. William Edward also contributed to this loan, besides making a personal loan to the Earl of £100 in March 1461. We see more links to the Yorkist regime in December 1460, when the grocers made loans to lend John Walden and his fellow staplers of Calais a load of money. And they did that based on the fact that the Yorkist nobles had already promised the staplers that their loans to the crown would be repaid quickly via taxes. The grocers' company and all the elements of it seemed entirely in support of the Yorkist faction. The most conspicuous absentee of this, of course, was the alderman Thomas Canning, the former Yorkist, former mayor, and now seen as somewhat mercenary political operator. But again, the grocers didn't support the Yorkists for ideological reasons. Sure, some long supported the Duke of York, but others like John King, he'd been prosecuted for giving illegal credit to aliens, which we covered a couple of chapters ago, and he resented the crap out of the King and Queen for doing this. All these circumstances had brought together the various members of the grocers and other livery companies to support the regime right now. Yet, at the heart of the company was a dozen men who stood out from the others due to the sheer scale of their contributions to the Yorkist regime, which suggests that they, with the new mayor of the Calais staple, John Walden, were the leaders of this Yorkist group in the grocer's company. Mayor Richard Lee's influence undoubtedly helps to account to for the loans amounting to about £11,000, which the City of London corporately advanced to the Yorkist nobles between July 1460 and April 1461. This was a huge amount, way more than the city lent to the Queen's group in a similar period, and shows the extent which they had committed themselves now to the Yorkist cause. And that being said, their confidence was now shaken because of the death of the Duke of York. Over the next 2 months, the Yorkists amongst the Londoners swung between fear and hope, as the situation elsewhere meant that London's future hung in the balance. The Mercers' Company granted the Earl of Warwick 500 marks of silver on the 8th of September 1461 in the hope of restoring Yorkist power after news of the disaster at Wakefield had reached London. Thomas Canning, by contrast, the former Yorkist supporter who, after his term in mayor, which we covered a few chapters ago, had become far more mercenary and now didn't seem to like either of the sides, he begged leave to retire from the position of alderman, but he was refused. It appeared that from the 12 aldermen who had voted not to fire on the Yorkist invaders in June, that the court of aldermen was evenly divided between those who supported the Yorkists and those who wanted everybody not to choose a side. And Canning, even though he was somewhat mercenary, he was in the Yorkist camp, and there was a fear that if he retired, The Yorkist group may lose control of the city. So they insisted he stayed in post. Former Mayor Thomas Canning really was having none of it. He wanted out of the politics. And his persistence seems to have been the reason for the mayor and his colleagues on the aldermanic bench to finally wash their hands of him. In January 1461, he was fined £40 and relieved of office. Richard Lee and the Yorkists in the city government now had to wait with some trepidation as to the outcome of the next battle before deciding what to do. Even by the standards of a tense and barely contained chaotic place, the streets of London that winter were filled with rumour and passion and turmoil. York's defeat and death after Wakefield was now well known around the country, and yet this fourth war still burned, and if anything, now burned brighter. The Duke of York's son, Edward, now 18 years old, 6 feet four and dashing, seemed to undergo a change in temperament. He stomped around basically saying, "Hello, my name is Edwin Plantagenet. You killed my father. Prepare to die. At everyone." And he was currently in Wales, leading an army against Henry VI's half-brother, Jasper Tudor. The Earl of Warwick remained in London and still held on to Henry VI as a prisoner, preventing any return to ordinary government. And yet, at the same time as all of this, Queen Margaret of Anjou was running amok in the north of England, and London heard whispers that she was travelling south to take her vengeance on the capital. London feared this and could not ignore the fact that this was now a full-blown civil war. The previous three wars had been smaller, and the battles they had produced had been quite sporadic, occasional outbursts of violence. But as 1461 dawned, there were now capital armies marching across the fields of England, made up of trained noble retainers, haphazardly conscripted lords' tenants, and foreign mercenaries. On the 2nd of February, 1461, Lord Edward, the Duke of York's son's army, clashed with that of Jasper Tudor, Owen Tudor, and James Butler, the Earl of Wiltshire, at a place called Mortimer's Cross in the Welsh Marches. Edward was facing quite a formidable enemy force, as the Earl of Wiltshire had brought over a large contingent of French and Breton mercenaries, as well as his own Irish retainers. But they had marched at pace across Wales from Pembroke, and they turned up at the battlefield tired. And in Edward they faced a commander who was learning how to inspire men to believe they simply could not lose. Edward attacked, his forces tore into the Royalist army, and he routed them. Jasper Tudor and the Earl of Wiltshire escaped the battlefield, but old Owen Tudor, now about 60, was captured, along with Sir John Throckmorton and several other Royalist commanders. They were taken to the nearby town of Hereford, where a chopping block had been erected in the marketplace. Now, Owen Tudor, the founder of that entire dynasty, stood before the residents and genuinely seemed shocked he was facing instant execution. He begged, quote, pardon and grace, unquote. But it was to no avail. Owen Tudor is of the previous generation. He didn't realise just how much hate was out there right now in the current generation. The collar of his doublet was rudely torn away and he was led towards his death. According to records, Owen Tudor's last words were to recall his wife, the Princess of France and Queen of England, who had seen fit to marry this humble Welshman and bear his children. Soon after, he was beheaded. Yet one battle does not dictate a war, and as Jasper Tudor and Wiltshire fled, eventually to take refuge in Scotland, and Earl Edward regrouped his forces in Hereford, Queen Margaret was mustering her other allies, including the Duke of Somerset and Exeter, and the Earls of Northumberland and Shrewsbury, and a huge number of northern lords, and they were joined by the ubiquitous Calais turncoat Andrew Trollope, and they set off south, destroying everything they found in their path. By February 10th, this violent army of hardened Northerners and foreign sellswords had burned and looted its way as far as Cambridgeshire. By the 16th, they had broken the defences of Dunstable and Barnes in Bedfordshire. London was close at hand, and the Earl of Warwick, in charge of both Henry VI and the government of England, was forced to act. Warwick took out a large army from the city, aided by John Mowbray, the Duke of Norfolk, John de la Pole, the Duke of Suffolk, William FitzAlan, the Earl of Arundel, and a clutch of their own peers, and his own brother, John Neville, his uncle, John Falkenberg, and the treasurer, Lord Bonville. This was the force that marched north to confront the king. London watched them leave, fearful, nervous. All rested on what would follow. and they saw that the palace of the Bishop of London was empty now. The king, the single most important hostage in the kingdom, he went with Warwick. He would not be left behind. Whatever was to become was to be all or nothing. As one writer at the time put it, a quote, "Great shedding of blood cannot be avoided, and whoever conquers, the crown of England loses, which is a very great pity," unquote. For the second time in less than 6 years, two opposing political forces met at the town of St. Albans. But boy, how things had changed. In the first of the civil wars, the fighting in St. Albans had been little more than a skirmish, and in 1455, only a few hundred men had ultimately taken part in a fight that was effectively a street riot waged on the streets. But right now, here on Shrove Tuesday, the 17th of February, 1461, this was total war. Thousands of men descended into the region, and St. Albans, still a town without walls, watched in utter terror as these forces came together. Despite the accusation that the Northern Army was just a rabble, it was commanded with discipline and cunning. They all marched wearing the symbols of young Edward, the Prince of Wales, a red and black band with an ostrich feathers. And the battle itself was decided relatively quickly. The Earl of Warwick's men were blindsided by enemy troops pouring into St. Albans at about 1 p.m. from the northwest rather than the northeast, which they were expecting, and after heavy fighting, the vanguard of the Yorkists was scattered, fleeing in every direction as Royalist cavalry thundered after them. King Henry VI was found, sat under a tree, laughing and singing as the battle raged about him. The two nobles appointed to guard him, Lord Bonville and Sir Thomas Kareely, were taken prisoner. The vindictive queen sent her 8-year-old son, Prince Edward, to pass sentence on them, and the boy duly condemned them to death, and both were executed there and then. Dazed and confused, Henry VI was reunited with his family, but no one was really paying any attention to him now. Witnesses talk of men being rounded up and run through with lances by their enemies all day. Finally, at about 6 p.m. when the sun set, the butchery stopped, and then St. Albans was looted and despoiled. War of the Roses scorecard, February 1461 edition. Number of wars, 4. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 3. Number of regimes since 1454, 7. Current regime, Henry VI is king and the queen is back in charge, but London and the south still resist them. After this victory then, as the screams of women and children of St. Albans echoed in her ears, Queen Margaret decided to push on to London. The capital must be brought to heel. From St. Albans, the Queen sent envoys ahead to London demanding supplies and money for her troops. This was a preliminary gesture to show good faith before the city finally submitted to her. The moment of crisis was now upon Mayor Richard Lee and the Aldermen of the Court of Aldermen. Would they accept this? London's future hung in the balance. Did they remember the events of many years previously, when the Empress Matilda had marched on London, gotten as far as Westminster before London turned on her? Would they resist? Who knows? The Aldermanic Council tried to calculate the risks they face. Besides the mayor, Richard Lee, it had 5 of the grocers as members, the same number of drapers and 4 mercers. The allegiances of most of the drapers can be inferred by the fact that their company, too, had lent York's son, Edward the Earl of March, £200 in January, as the mercers had given 500 marks to Warwick after the defeat at Wakefield. So the drapers were in with the Yorkists, and they probably were influenced by the fact that they, like the grocers, had been victims of the royal prosecutions for illegal credit the previous year. They also, like the grocers, had much to lose from the growth of Italian competition and trade between London and Antwerp. And given this, it does mean that the Alderman's decision to give in to the Queen's demand and to admit 400 of her men into the city to pick up supplies was more likely or not a decision to play for time. Rumours had reached London that the Earls of March and Warwick had joined forces in the Cotswolds and were regrouping to liberate the capital. So London sent word to Queen Margaret, "Send an advance guard, Your Majesty, and we'll supply them with provisions for your troops and money for their pay." But in this, the Aldermen of London were being prudent. And yet the Aldermen of London did not recognise the passion of the people of London. London was not united as one, yes, but what follows is often said to be the actions of Yorkist supporters of the city by several historians. But from the point of view of this podcast and any understanding of London itself, London as a city had swung the year before violently pro-Yorkist, if only because of the resentment and anger from the events at the year before. As we covered last chapter, the Royalist faction had fired cannons at point-blank range into the houses of London. They'd used wildfire upon neighbourhoods. The nobles of the Royalist faction had killed innocent men, women and children the previous July. And now, 7 months later, the city's supposed to stand by as they give the freaking Queen food, supplies and money. Yeah, you can hear London turn round to their alderman and mayor and say, "You can shove that idea right up your arse." As the carts laden with supplies for the approaching army began being dragged through the city towards Cripplegate and the road leading north, a group of citizens came into the streets to block them. Quote, "The commons of the city took the victuals from the carts and would not suffer it to pass," unquote, wrote a chronicle. This mob insisted that the city's governor send a delegation to tell the Queen that she could not enter London while the feared northern men remained in a party. They were just looking up at St. Albans burning and just went, sod that. This mob of Londoners refused to allow the Queen turn up with her army. Some of Margaret's advance guard, or the Londoners who were there to secure this convoy, had tried to resist, and the mob of Londoners had no time for it. With a bit of violence, the goods were seized, the city's gates were closed, and the Queen was told, "If she wants to come to London, London's ready for a fight." The mayor and the authorities went along with it. They weren't stupid, and so a message was sent. And as she approached, Queen Margaret of Anjou now faced a dilemma. London was ready to oppose her. And she could not just say it was Mayor Lee, the Yorkist, leading this defiance. She probably would have known the temper of the city. London was pissed and out for revenge. This was a city who had taken Lord Scales and shivved him to death. She wanted a vicious fight. If her vicious northerners figured they could intimidate a city like London, well, come on then. Technically, the Queen knew that if she turned up, there would have to be a siege. And a siege with a city that had some heavy firepower in the forms of its own artillery. And as it's shown during the Jack Cade Revolt, they're willing to use that artillery in the streets. And any siege she would partake would leave her army vulnerable to flank attack from the Earl of Warwick. No, she and her advisers realised London, giving Queen Margaret of Anjou the finger right now, forced her to back down. She would have to take her husband and her son back north to the Midlands. And this move, and London's communal decision that it was safer to hold with the defeatist Yorkists than with the victorious Queen, would prove pivotal in the continuing war to come. On the 27th of February then, the Earl of March arrived in London and was greeted as a liberator. His father, the Duke of York, had never received such a glorious welcome as he did that day. He was not only able to arrive as a liberator from the threat of rapine and looting from the Queen's forces, but he was able to be the bearer of fair promise for those merchants and livery companies that had given him their support and their cash. But right now, he was a man who had to make a very hard political choice. The Earl of Warwick and Edward Earl of March had escaped the destruction of the Duke of York and by the end of the month had regrouped in the Cotswolds and had developed an armed force. With Warwick losing control of Henry VI, however, they lost their ability to run a damn thing. And yet, the recently passed accord between King Henry and the late Richard Duke of York meant that, technically, according to the newly made law of the land, the Earl of March was now heir to the crown. And as he marched to London, Edward knew that to avenge his father and also to have any chance at victory, he would need to become king. And to become king, he would need London to make him so. It is a romantic device of mine, I will admit, to emphasise London's ability to choose the kings of England. And while I will accept someone, if they wish to criticise me for allowing the drama of the narrative, emphasise this in a way that perhaps others at the time maybe would not have, in truth, we can see now again, in 1461, that peculiar right of London to pick a king. London chose kings. The city would pick a king and impose their choice upon the rest of the country, even if the rest of the country didn't like it. We'd seen them pick King Harold I back in chapter 38. We'd seen London pick Edmund Ironsides back in chapter 40. We'd seen London pick Stephen of Blois in chapter 62. We'd seen them pick the short-lived reign of Prince Louis of France in chapter 85. And numerous also were the times where London as a city sided with a king when no one else would. Kings like Æthelred Undred. Or they'd oppose a king against all odds, like they did King John or Richard II. London had, deep in its DNA, this sense of gravitas. And it's right now that this gravitas that Edward, the Earl of March, was seeking. But even if the support of London was vital to his plans of becoming king, the aldermen of London were not entirely united in the Yorkist cause. Richard Lee was risking the fate of Nicholas Brembe by forsaking his allegiance to Henry VI. But in light of that siege of the Tower of London and the driving off of the Queen and her army, regardless of what other historians say, I believe the die was cast. London had picked a side fully. And could now it could only follow the path they had laid before them. And with their choices made, all that was left was theatre. On Thursday, the 26th of February, 1461, the Earl of March rode into London, accompanied by the Earl of Warwick and their surviving noble allies. It was early Lent. The city was already in a religious festive mood, and his arrival was greeted with huge rejoicing. Songs and rhymes were composed and sung, quote, "Let us walk in a new vineyard, and let us make gay garden in the month of March, with this fair white rose and herb, the Earl of March," unquote. It helped that the Earl of March had inherited his late father's London residence, Baynard's Castle, and thus to London, Edward was literally living amidst them. Edward, however, needed the throne, and so on Sunday the 1st of March, a huge crowd gathered in St. John's Field, just outside the city. The reports say this crowd was thousands strong, made up of citizens from the city and, well, since we know it's a field of St. John's, this is where the Yorkists traditionally garrisoned their troops, so there were thousands of their soldiers already there. This crowd was seething with the passions of London, a passion kindled the previous summer by the massacre caused during the siege. It would not take much for a capable speaker to kindle that passion into a flame. Coming before them was the Earl of Warwick's brother, George Neville, the Bishop of Exeter and acting Chancellor of England. Neville delivered a barnstorming speech. He detailed a case against Henry VI, pointing out that by returning to his rebellious queen, he'd broken the legal agreement he had made with Parliament only the year before. The Bishop of Exeter asked the crowd if they wished him to remain as king. According to one chronicler, who, yes, we must take on board as biased as hell, quote, "The people cried, nay, nay, and then they asked if they would have the Earl of March to be their king, and they said, yay, yay," unquote. The following Monday morning, London was plastered with bills on walls and doors detailing the legal claim to the throne by Edward, and the next day, Tuesday the 3rd of March, Edward held a council meeting in Baynard's Castle where a handful of bishops and lords were present, and here, in the heart of the city, they gave their assent to his claim to the throne. And thus on the morning of March 4th, 1461, the theatre of this event reached its final act here on the streets of London. in grand old St. Paul's Cathedral, just down the road from Baynard's Castle, a solemn and wonderful Te Deum Mass was sung. The Bishop of Exeter then strode to St. Paul's Cross, the crucial public pulpit next door to the cathedral, and before a massive crowd of residents delivered another political sermon extolling the right of Edward to claim the throne. Edward himself, in formal attire, rode out of Baynard's, out of the city, along Fleet Street, turning left at the cross at Charing, and then rode down to Westminster. With him was a small band of nobles and some carefully selected commoners, including the Mayor of the London, Richard Lee. Before the select audience, and with their acclamation, Edward was ceremoniously installed in the marble chair of the King's Bench and proclaimed King of England and France and Lord of Ireland. It's obvious at this point that the ceremony mirrored what had been done 62 years earlier when Henry IV had displaced Richard II. Back then as now, Parliament was not formally involved. During that ceremony then, quote, "He was sworn afore the Bishop of Canterbury and the Chancellor of England and the Lords, that he should truly and justly keep the realm and the laws thereof and maintain as a true and just king," unquote. Edward then put on the robes and cap of state, although not a crown, because this was not a coronation. And it should be noticed he was sat ceremoniously upon the King's Bench, the marble chair in one of the two highest common law courts in England, which symbolised the personal authority of a king as a judge. And this symbolic act done, Edward stood and left the palace, crossing the short way to Westminster Abbey Church to make an offering at the shrine of his namesake, St. Edward the Confessor. He had not been appointed, no crown sat upon his head, but in the eyes of his supporters and London, King Edward IV was now the true inheritor of the crowns of England and France and the Lordship of Ireland. War the Roses scorecard, March 1461 edition. Number of wars, 4. Number of times Henry VI had been captured, 3. Number of regimes since 1545, 8. Current regime, Henry VI is king, with the Queen running his forces up north, and in London, Edward IV is king also. 2 kings, 1 crown. With the nation now split, with there being 2 kings in the country, the momentum for this war took a life of its own. The land saw Queen Margaret and her allies raise the north of England for battle, while those loyal to Edward's men raised the realm below the River Trent for battle. Edward's people sent instructions to the sheriffs of more than 30 southern counties, damning, quote, "he that calls himself Henry VI," unquote, and demanding all manner of men between 60 and 16 summoned to come join their new king's forces. Throughout March 1461, the whole of England marshalled for war. They came from everywhere, between Wales and East Anglia, from Scotland to Kent. Edward's army actually included a company of soldiers sent by Duke Philip of Burgundy, courtesy of the Earl of Warwick. They marched under the banner of Louis the Dauphin of France and the eldest son of Charles VII. The royalists of the Queen had the lion's share of the nobles of England, the Duke of Somerset and Exeter, the Earls of Northumberland, Wiltshire and Devon, Lord Rivers, his son Anthony Woodville. They also had Sir Andrew Trollope, a man who had been knighted by the Queen after the Second Battle of St. Albans, and they had dozens of other peers. And what follows was one of the largest gatherings of men for a battle seen in the history of this nation. While we contend with medieval exaggeration and hyperbole, we have to accept that there were tens of thousands of men in the field right now. One comment I saw in one book said it represented 1% of the English population was now armed for war. And even if we take on board usual exaggerations, these were now 2 gigantic armies. And this fourth civil war now faced its brutal end campaign. The first battle took place on Saturday the 28th of March at Ferrybridge in Yorkshire, a crossing point on the Great North Road, just a few miles northwest of Pontefract. And that was followed the next day at the Battle of Taunton. This is the story of London, and so I make no apology for not getting into the amazing tale of this campaign, of the bravery and savagery of its nobles, of the determination and desperation of their men. I could offer an entire chapter of this podcast to describe the fighting that took place in the driving snow and wind of that wild Yorkshire territory, and I still wouldn't do it justice. But since our focus is to tell the story of the city, I'll simply leap now to its conclusion. Edward IV gained a bloody and savage victory that day. They say in the aftermath of the battle, some of the defeated were able to escape to safety by a bridge of bodies made up of their fellow soldiers, slain across a nearby watercourse. The Earl of Wiltshire lay dead. The Earl of Northumberland lay dead. Warwick's nemesis, Sir Andrew Trollope, was killed. The Earl of Devon was crippled and then executed. Any examination of the results of that single battle show it was pure carnage. Skulls were found around the battlefield that show just horrific injuries. Faces split down to the bone, heads cut in half, holes punched straight through foreheads. Some men died with more than 20 wounds to the head. It was a frenzied slaughter by men whipped into a state of barbaric bloodlust. Many victims were mutilated, nose and ears as ripped off, fingers snipped from hands to remove rings and jewellery. The field of Taunton was known as the Bloody Meadow, and with good reason. On the 7th of April in 1461, Bishop Neville of Exeter wrote to the Bishop of Tremino in Flanders. He reported the events of the 6 weeks that had just passed, including the slaughter at St. Albans, Ferry Bridge and Taunton, and estimated that 28,000 men had been killed in all the battles. Alas, he wrote, we are a race deserving of pity even more than the French. The Fourth Civil War was over. Queen Margaret had prudently kept her enfeebled husband and young son back away from the bloodbath at Taunton, but now they all retreated to Scotland. With them were their few remaining noble allies, the Duke of Somerset and Exeter, Lord Roos and the judge Sir John Fortescue. Other loyalists to Henry VI, such as Jasper Tudor, the Earl of Pembroke, soon joined them, but this was simply a fragmented, shattered remnant of the previous regime. They were militarily ruined, they were financially crippled, and they were exhausted. In all ways, Edward IV had won, and even if Henry VI and his son remained alive and out there in the ether of exile, Edward IV was now king, and London's faith in him had been vindicated. King Edward IV spent a month in the north mopping up resistance before returning to London in triumph that May for the coronation that would set God's seal upon his accession to the crown. He could now claim not only to be king by right of blood, but to have his claim vindicated by right of battle. And as Edward returned to London, the city, its mayor, its grocers, its staplers, its mercers and its drapers would have rejoiced. Their candidate for king had won. The future seemed bright. War of the Roses scorecard, May 1461 edition. Number of wars, 4. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 3. Number of regimes since 1545, 8. Current regime, Edward IV, King of England, and his rivals are now all in exile. The coronation of Edward in Westminster was pure theatre. Yes, future wars may happen. But for an exhausted nation, and for a very exhausted city, this political theatre, they hoped, would bring the curtain down on the horrendous events that had gripped the nation for these many years. And while we know this was not to be so, we're going to leave London in hope. And for those on the winning side, including the city itself, relishing what they hoped would be the upcoming rewards of their victory. Thanks for listening. Hope you could follow it. Hell of a lot going on in it. Story of London exists without any kind of advertising, as you may have noticed, although I'm tempted to do it because I can earn some money. But I don't do it for now, and we exist due to contributions from listeners. These contributions don't make us rich. They just pay for the hosting fees for this podcast. If you can make one, that'll be fantastic. If you follow the link to the Buy Me a Coffee page, you can make a contribution there. If you don't feel like doing that, then guess what? That's all cool. Don't do that. If you'd like to show support in another way, maybe give us a 5-star review, either on Spotify or over on Apple, which is the two places most people listen to this. But it is on other platforms as well. And if you don't fancy doing any of that, if you enjoyed the episode, then I'm delighted anyway. So yeah. Hope you're okay. This is Saul saying have a really good week, and I'll see you next week for another chapter in the story of London. Thank you. Bye.